Go. Okay, so we're starting this week to learn about the first principle of faith, Emuna, which happens to also be, according to the Rambam, the first of the Taryag Mitzvahs. Now, parenthetically, it's a very interesting thing. I don't know if you're familiar with the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvahs, but the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvahs actually lists Emuna as the first mitzvah. So we've spoken about it a little. We're going to talk more about it. We touched upon the difference between principles of faith and mitzvahs, which are two separate things. We'll speak more about it. But certainly when it comes to the first two principles of faith, Emuna and Achdus, Emuna b'Hashem and Achdus Hashem, which are the two principles of faith, those are also the two first mitzvahs that the Rambam lists. So obviously it goes without saying how important they are. And especially based on what we began learning last week, that the Pnimizdik Inyan of the Ikari Amuna, the Pnimizdik Inyan of what are these fundamentals of faith, if all of Torah is true, they're about you subjectively becoming a vessel for Hashem, allowing your conscious self to become a vessel to Hashem. Probably out of all the 13 principles, the first two are the most important, which is why they're the first two. They're the most important, which is why they're the first two, and they're also the first two mitzvahs. Now, I just want to point out something fascinating. In the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvahs, he lists Emunah as the first mitzvah. Does anyone have any idea what pasuk the Rambam brings? Where do we learn out the mitzvah of Emunah from? What pasuk? Please tell me someone knows. Huh? What pasuk do we learn out the mitzvah of Emunah b'Hashem? If nobody knows, then we need to have this chabur once a day, not once a week. Huh? Thank you. The first commandment. Thank you. Anoichi Hashem Elokecha. The first of the Ten Commandments. It's the first of the Ten Commandments. Anoichi Hashem Elokecha. I'm sure you've noticed that Anoichi Hashem Elokecha is not written any... That doesn't seem to be a mitzvah. Anoichi Hashem Elokecha. It's just like God giving his business card or something. That doesn't seem to be a mitzvah there. But we learn out that that's the source of being one of the Taryag Mitzvahs. Anoichi Hashem Elokecha, the first commandment. Interestingly, I'm not getting into this now in depth, but you should know that the Zohar lists Emunah as Pikuda Kadma, the first mitzvah, also brings the Pasuk Anoich Hashem Elokecha. And those that say that the Rambam was exposed to the Zohar, because there's a whole big controversy about that, Yesh Oimrim, that's one of the places that the Rambam got that from. Because Anoich Hashem Elokecha, Pashtus doesn't seem to be saying any mitzvah. But the Rambam learns out that that's where we learn out the mitzvah of Emunah from Anoich Hashem Elokecha. Now, what's interesting to note about the Sefer HaMitzvahs of the Rambam, is it true that that is the first mitzvah that appears in the Torah? The Rambam lists it as the first mitzvah in Sefer HaMitzvahs. Is that the first mitzvah that appears in the Torah, Anoich Hashem Elokecha? No, the quite a lot of mitzvahs before, right? Lots of mitzvahs before. And yet the Rambam lists it as the first in Sefer HaMitzvahs. The second in Sefer HaMitzvahs is Shema Yisrael, Hashem Echad, Achdus Hashem. What parsha is that in? In Vayeschanan, in Dvarim. Which means, obviously, we know, what do we know about the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvahs? That it's not chronological. Very important. You need to know this. Sefer HaMitzvahs of the Rambam is not written according to the order of how they appear in the Torah. Not at all. The first mitzvah in Sefer HaMitzvahs is Emunah. Second, Achdus Hashem. Third one, Yiras Hashem. Avas Hashem. Not in the order they appear in the Torah. Which means that the Rambam, as the ultimate codifier, is, it's like almost crazy. It's a perush. The way the Rambam lists the mitzvahs is itself a perush. Do you understand? The way that he's listing the mitzvahs, the order and how he's putting the mitzvahs is itself a perush. Is itself an explanation. Is itself has depth to it. He's not just listing them. The Sefer HaChinuch, I'm sure you're familiar with Sefer HaChinuch, how does he list the mitzvahs? According to Parsha, right? But the Rambam doesn't. He lists it in importance. So that itself, that the Rambam, he's being mefarish, he's explaining to you that he's listing the mitzvahs in such a way, that itself shows you how fundamental those mitzvahs are. Those mitzvahs of emuna, achdus Hashem, and which brings to avas Hashem and yiras Hashem, which we mentioned already. That's the first bir halacha. Also, the Chavetz Chaim starts his Mishnah Berurah with the chinuch that says that the sheish mitzvahs tamidius. So we see already how fundamental emuna b'Hashem is. How the Rambam lists it as the very first mitzvah. Now, so I'm assuming you're all from. I'm assuming that because you're all wearing yarmulkes. So I'm assuming you all do the mitzvah of emunah. And we just mentioned it's a mitzvah tmidis. It's a constant mitzvah. So who wants to be the korban that's going to volunteer and answer the following question? What is the mitzvah of emunah and the principle of faith of emunah? Anyone want a shot at it? What is the mitzvah of emunah b'Hashem? Everyone's afraid? Huh? Yeah, Sam?
Doesn't the Tanya...
Whoa, wait. Hold your horses. Tanya is a no-go, and I'll tell you why. When we learn Bechlal Torah, one of the important things in learning Torah is to know that Pardes are four separate... The four parts of Torah, and Cholent is a great thing to eat Shabbos afternoon. Not when you learn Torah. One should never make a cholent of pshat, rumas, drusha, soid, and chassidus. One could always connect them. I'm all into that. But one has to be very careful to be able to define things, which is why the title of this chabura is the 13 principles of faith in theology, philosophy, and chassidus. Because we have to know what the rishonim held. We have to know what philosophy says. And then we could learn what chassidus says. Trust me, I appreciate chassidus. I'm with you. But we have to see chassidus as, either you want to say, I'm going to be careful in the words I use, you could see chassidus as adding a new depth or revealing a new depth to what the Rishonim are saying. But you have to first know what the Rishonim say, the poiskim, right? We have to go in order, not make a cholon. I'm not picking on you, Sam.
I'm just happened to say.
Huh?
First carbon.
Right. I'm sorry. I hope you're moichel me. And I want you to understand, it's not just in order to be able to know what everyone's saying, but number one, to be able to appreciate what chassidus says, you have to first see what the other rishonim say, right? And you have to be able to know everyone wants. So let's, before we get to Tanya, according to pshat, Rambam, pshat, rishonim, pshat, what is the mitzvah muna b'Hashem? Yeah? Oh, thank you. You have to believe that God exists. That's the answer I was waiting for, and that is wrong. But that's what I wanted someone to say it. You were brave, thank you. Everyone usually says the mitzvah of moon is to believe that God exists. Now, obviously, God does exist. Well, depends how you define existence, as we'll talk about. Because the truth is, God doesn't exist. Just the phrase itself, God exists, is a wrong phrase, which we're going to learn about today, Mitzvah Shem. God doesn't exist. God is existence. And it's a very big difference, a philosophical difference, which is relevant to pshat. And we're going to speak about that. So when people say, to prove to me God exists, my response is, he doesn't. He doesn't exist. He is existence. We'll get to. But one way or the other, before we get to that in which we'll speak about at length, but so that's why how important it is. I'm not trying to be annoying or pedantic. I'm trying to show you how important what we're learning is. That's it's so important in Yiddishkeit to get clear these inyanim. So putting aside for a second that very important semantic difference, because I always, you know, semantics really matter in theology. Now everyone always says, oh, semantics, what are you, just semantics? Semantics really matter in theology. Big time. Big time semantics matter. How you say things, what you mean, is one of the most difficult parts about learning theology, about learning Torah, these inyanim. But that's why it's so important to get them clearly. So without getting into that semantic difference, at this point, most people, most from Jews would say the mitzvah emun is to believe that God exists, leaving aside for the fact that that's an incorrect way of saying this phrase, but it's also not the mitzvah emunah. It's not. According to almost all the Rishonim, that's not the mitzvah emunah. To just believe that God exists. Yeah? You have a question?
No.
So, of course, Yeah?
Maybe it's only that he has a shkafa on this. That he exists, that he has a shkafa over and he's actively involved.
Why would you say that it has to do with hashkacha? Are you saying that because of the nusach of the 13 animamans?
No, I mean, I kind of just treated it like the bir halacha.
At the what?
At the bir halacha.
Okay. The bir halacha is getting it from nusach animamans, which is also very shver. So, but I hear you, but you understand that hashgacha, if you speak about hashgacha, so in the principles of faith, that's the tenth principle of faith. The tenth principle of faith is God's omniscience. God's omniscience, which means hashgacha, we call hashgacha pratis, that God knows everything that's happening. That's the tenth principle of faith. It's completely different than the first one. So let's leave the lashon bir halacha, yeah?
I think you probably have to live.
I mean, that's definitely true. You have to live your life based on emunah, but I'm sure you would agree that's not the mitzvah of emunah, right? We're trying to define here, again, that's what I'm saying, to not make a cholent means to be very careful to define each thing what it is. We have to live according to emunah, like Rav Nachman writes in the 31st turn, the Likutei Maran. Rav Nachman speaks, actually just, I had a beautiful, I saw it recently again, and I had such a hanah from it. Anyone mind if I go a little off topic for 3 minutes? Okay, great. So, I saw it again. I had such a geschmack. Rav Nachman writes in the 31st Torah that the shleimus of emunah is bris, shmiras habris. Shoivavim is coming up. And it was the first time I chapped what Rav Nachman is saying. What's the pshat? I forgot that he says, ein kiyum lemunah ele edei habris. And I chapped what Rav Nachman is saying, that the way that you see that emunah has fully penetrated you, like you're saying, remind me your name again.
Jacob.
What Jacob said, the way that you see emunah fully penetrated you, is that imamish brisi nemenesloi. That's the pasuk Rav Nachman brings. Brisi nemenesloi. My bris is neman, is trustworthy, is faithful to God. The emunah becomes such a big part of me that it's chayder, that it penetrates, that a mamish goes all the way to my bris, which is the lowest, so to speak, part of who I am, that it's nemenesle, that my bris is also neman to Hashem. So of course what you're saying, Jacob, is true, that the way that we know that emunah is ultimately done properly, ultimately is that it goes, that it penetrates, that it has a it's so clear to me and such a part of who I am. And for those who were here last week, I become a little closer to Isaac Newton, right? I became a little more a vessel that emunah has come to the place that I have shmiras habris. That's how Rav Nachman learns the idea, brisi ne'menesle. That imamish goes to, like say, that imamish becomes so real, ad kadeh, that's like the Evan Abaychan, that you've come to a place where you have shlemas emunah. Which, of course, clarification, you know, Shleimus Hamunah means Shleimus Hamunah, which means there's about a billion levels until then. So it doesn't mean if you don't have Shmiras Habris, you don't have Amunah. That's not what Rav Nachman is saying. He's saying Kiyam Amunah, which means ultimate Amunah is Brisi Nemenesli. So of course that's true, that if you come to the high... does everyone know how do I say this? How often does one have to work on emunah? How often does one have to work on having emunah? Every day. Every day. Every day a person has to work on having emunah. So these inyanim we're talking about is halacha lamaisa. So it's a whole derech. Coming to emunah is the more you go, the deeper you go, you get more and more emunah. It's not like something that you just like fill out in your form, I believe in God, check. It's a whole derech to have deeper levels of it. So the ultimate thing is brisi nemenesle, that a mamish goes until ad kadei kach, that your whole life, you're a varim, all your limbs are completely, you know, filled and permeated with the light of Hashem. You've opened yourself up to emunah to the extent that it's brisi nemenesle. 100%, that's true. But that's not the definition of what emunah is. Yeah?
I mean, the lashon of the mitzvah also sounds like it's some level of hashkafa or the
reason behind it. It's some level of it. So we'll see the lashon and the sefer on mitzvahs. Why do you say? I didn't give it out yet. But why do you say that it's mashma that in the sefer mitzvahs is a lashon that of hashgacha? Poel and nimtzchol mitzayim doesn't mean hashgacha. It means that he created everything. Right. That's the reason. Even in deism. Does everyone know what deism is? The difference between deism and theism? Deism are those that believe in God, but not that you could have a relationship, not that God has a relationship with reality. That's a deist. The deism is that there is a God, whether it's Plato, Aristotle, you know, that there is a God, but that he doesn't have a relationship. Theism, from the Lashon theology, theos means a God like we know God, that he cares about us, that he's into, you know, that he has a, he's into the world. That's so that Lashon of Poel Acholinim Tzayim, that he's the cause of everything, that's in deism as well. But let's not, so let's go. Obviously, Ashgacha Pratis is going to be a Pol Yotze that's going to come from everything from Emunah, but that's done, still not what Emunah is. Now, Ashgacha Pratis, again, is a step B. You understand? Even if you say it had that, whatever the Chavetz Chaim, I don't remember, is Lashon Bir Halacha, but it's certainly not the mitzvah of Emunah. Yeah?
God could intervene in nature.
God could intervene in nature. Well, I mean, you're right that that would be a result of Emunah, would be that God could intervene in nature. It would be a result of having Emunah. It's, again, a result of it. So let's learn. Let's learn. So before we get into the Rambam, I want to first begin by discussing something very, very important. Before we get, as a Hakdama to the Rambam. And that is, and this is going to be Hakdama as we move along for the next couple of weeks or months or however long it takes us, because Emunah, we're going to spend a lot of time because it's very important to get it clearly. But as we move on, it's very important to differentiate, very important, between, before we define what Emunah is even, we have to differentiate between two different types of ways of describing what faith means and is. Very important, before we even get to details. There's the scholastic, medieval, Rishonim way of explaining what Emunah is. And then there's the Hasidic, so to speak, mystical more understanding of what Emunah is. I saw this, Rav Shagar speaks about this a lot. The difference between a cognitive acceptance of something or an experience that you're having in you. An experience that does, that's not something that's necessarily cognitive. The philosophers, when they talk about faith, they're usually discussing something cognitive that's happening in your mind. Something that you could explain in your mind. I could explain it in my mind. It's a piece of information that I understand, that I could explain. That's the philosophic way of understanding faith. It's a cognitive step.
It's like I downed, I hit.
What's that?
Is it like I downed, I hit?
No, not necessarily. Oh, you mean these, the difference between these two ways of Emunah? Yeah. That might be a result. It might be that a person that only has the philosophic type of faith, where God is a proposition, it might be like the I-it type of relationship. That's true, and yes, but it doesn't have to be like that. The Hasidic way of understanding Emunah is an experience, which is what the Baal Shem Tov said, Emunah hi advekus, which I mentioned earlier. According to Baal Shem Tov, Emunah and Dveikus are synonymous, really, which hasn't yet defined what Emunah is. It's just Baal Shem Tov is just saying, when you're going to have Emunah, which we'll learn what Hasidus says that is, when you'll be having Emunah, you are having Dveikus. Does everyone understand that that's, we haven't yet, the Baal Shem Tov is not defining what Emunah is. Hamunah hi advekus means when you're having Emunah, you're having Dveikus. When we get to the Hasidic understanding of what Emunah is, we'll understand that it's the same thing as Dveikus. It's an experiencing of God. It's not a cognition. Now, why am I saying this at this point before we even get to define what Emunah is according to the Rishonim? I'm making this differentiation for a very important reason as an introduction, the first step as we get into Emunah. And that is that I'm telling you, and this might bother many of you, what I'm about to say. One cannot ever prove the existence of God. I hate to break it to you, but in having gone through historically the history that we went through of letters, of learning, it has been accepted almost universally by everyone in Klal Yisrael, Bizman Hazeh, that it's a waste of time to try to prove that God exists. There are many Rishonim that speak about, quote-unquote, proofs for the existence of God. And we'll speak about the main three ones we'll touch upon today. I just wonder, by the way, how many people here are studying philosophy over here in Yeshiva? Anyone here studying Jewish philosophy? It's like if I spoke about the theological, cosmological, and ontological proof, would you know about that or not? Not yet. Okay. So there are, quote-unquote, proofs for the existence of God throughout the history of philosophy, by Jews, by Christians, by Muslims, throughout the Middle Ages, hundreds of years back and forth. Is it proof of God? Not proof of God? Yes, proof of God. All over the place there's this debate back and forth. But since Immanuel Kant, it's almost universally accepted by all Jews that we agree with Kant that if we just go based on reason, on your mind, on cognition, you can't prove God's existence. So very important to say already at this point that whatever the mitzvah of emunah is, it's not proofs for God's existence. It's not engaging in proofs. You will not be able to prove completely. There are those that want to say that it's almost proof. It depends how you define proof. We could get in those pilpulim afterwards. But since Immanuel Kant, it's impossible. He did such a good job of destroying all the theological proofs that were from the Middle Ages that all the Jews in Europe after Kant in the 19th century had to come up with other things, other ways of understanding emunah. Anyone that their whole Yiddishkeit was based on proofs, which we're going to discuss why in a moment. I just want to point out there is one person, the one tzaddik that says that the mitzvah of emunah does include proofs, and that's the Abar Benel. The Abar Benel does say that hachakirois v'hadrishois, the investigations, proofs, etc., that is part of the mitzvah of emunah. That's only according to the Abar Benel, but certainly in the other Rishonim we don't find that. Okay? Now, that's why what we're going to discuss today, make this clear. What we're going to discuss today for the rest of today's class is the philosophical Rishonim type of way of speaking about emunah, which we're going to agree cannot be proven with absolute certainty. We can't prove it. But the mitzvah emunah, the way that the tzaddikim taught, of experiencing God, that feeling that you have in you of God's existence, that doesn't need proof. And we're going to speak about that. That also, there are those in the philosophical world that also held like that. Descartes, for instance, is very close to what Chassidus says. Descartes and the Alter Rebbe almost say the exact same thing when it comes to emunah. So the reason I'm just saying this now is because what we're about to get into now is going to get philosophical, and at 1 o'clock you're all going to be out the door. So I want to just give you as a hakdamah to we're about to learn the mitzvah emunah that you should be living with right now, and we're going to put words to it and articulate and learn what that means more in depth. But the mitzvah emunah that right now when you walk out the door should be is that when you walk around the street and you have before you start thinking, you have that feeling of God's presence, that feeling of God, that's emunah. Now, I didn't explain anything, but that's the aspect of emunah that you should be living with right now. We'll put a lot more words to it, okay? But I'm just going to say that what we're going to talk about now shouldn't shter your avodas Hashem of emunah, which is essentially opening yourself up to the presence of God that shines in our soul. Okay? Opening yourself up to the presence of God, the light of God that's shining in your soul, that's ultimately the emunah that you could be doing now. And if you have that, you don't have to be afraid to engage in the philosophy, the philosophical discussion of emunah. Does everyone understand what I'm saying? For instance, the Rav Soloveitchik, the reason that he's able to write, he writes clearly, he never discussed Bible criticism, he writes the beginning of Lonely Men of Faith, he never got into the whole idea of proofs about God's existence. In fact, the Rav makes fun of that in Lonely Men of Faith. He speaks about that proofs of God's existence, the Rav also says, is that that was never something that was a contingent necessity for Jews. He actually quotes Kierkegaard. They're in Lonely Man of Faith, he quotes Kierkegaard that made fun of St. Anselm of No, I forgot his name. Anselm of Canterbury, I believe. Anselm of Canterbury has the famous ontological proof of God's existence. And it says that he fasted and prayed for like 3 weeks to come up with this proof of God's existence. And Kierkegaard made fun and said, does the bride in her groom's embrace, loving embrace, need to ask for proofs of her lover's existence? That's the way the Rav quotes it. When a bride is in her lover's embrace and the groom's embrace, does she need to ask for proofs of his existence? Which Kierkegaard is making fun that Anselm is praying to God to give him a proof that God exists. It's like it's a contradiction in terms. You're being hugged by your beloved. Why would you need to be proved that he exists? So the Rav also had no problem with these inyanim of whether God actually to prove whether God exists or not. And the reason is because ultimately the emunah that we go with is that our soul feels God. Hashem shines in our soul. As we're going to learn a lot more about Arichus. But that's why I just want to say, so that type of emunah, the Avodas Hashem type of emunah, hold on to us. We're going to go the next couple of weeks. But now we need to speak in Rishayim in philosophic language. Yeah.
Yeah, so just in that vein, does that mean that like the Avodas Tefillah is outside the Avodas Emunah? Is it two different things? What we're trying to do? Or we want to at least establish that you have to have one before the other?
So Tefillah is the time to strengthen emunah. Tefillah is the time to strengthen the sheish mitzvahs tmidis. Tefillah is the time that you're... There's actually a very famous letter from the Alter Rebbe. I don't want to get too off topic, but because you asked the question, there's a famous letter that the Alter Rebbe writes. Ha'oimrim mitzvahs tefillah derabbanan leiro ma'oris miyameim. It's actually a fascinating letter that the Alter Rebbe wrote to Rabbi Alexander of Shklov. I actually mentioned it, Zev, you were there. Yitzchak Kislev, we spoke about it, right? You were there? So it's a very interesting letter where the Misnagdim were making fun of this chassid that he was spending hours and hours davening. That was their taina back then. That chassidim would spend 4, 5, 6 hours davening. So they had a big taina, it's bittul Torah. Could you imagine that today that would be the taina? They take 6 hours to daven, bittul Torah. So, but their taina was that the Talmud Torah connected kulam. Tefillah is only derabanan. Talmud Torah is a derais and Talmud Torah connected kulam. It's bittul Torah to spend so many hours davening. And the Alter Rebbe is a whole long letter answering, but basically what he answers is that if you say tefillah is only derabanan, you've never seen light or the luminary in your life. Why? Because although the nusach and the kviyas of 3 times a day is only derabanan, but the inyan hatfilah, which is the time where you're supposed to be focusing on amunah, aftos and avaviyira, that tefillah is the time to be working on your amunah, to be able to last until the next tefillah. Tefillah is the time to be, especially if you, we spoke about, for those that were here last week, if you remember, we learned about that to actually be make yourself a vessel, to be completely permeated with Hashem in your mind, that's what tefillah is supposed to be all about. So tefillah is the time to be working on emunah, etc. Okay? Now, so, just to go through this inyan now, why God's existence cannot be proven, what the main proofs are, and why it can't be proven. Just to take that, because we wouldn't have a davar shalom, we wouldn't be able to really go through the sugya of emunah vidarft zayin if we don't, as we're supposed to, unless we first clarify these inyanim. Okay, so scholastically, and again, and don't forget, I hope you remember when I say that Bechlal, the whole idea that God existing is not at all the mitzvah emunah. Mitzvah emunah is something more than that. But first we're talking about the fact that whether the existence of God, the fact that there are proofs for the existence of God, is not the mitzvah emunah. Okay? So the three famous proofs in the history of philosophy for the proof that of God's existence are known as the ontological proof. Do we have a thing here? Yes, now. Anyone that actually works? So, ontological proof, I'll just spell it out. Ontological, it's okay, Sam, I'll just spell it out. Ontological, ontological. The cosmological, C-O-S-M, O-L-O-G-I-C-A-L. And teleological, T-E-L-E-O-G-I-C-A-L. Okay? The ontological proofs from God's existence, which traces itself to Anselm of Canterbury, is the proof. His proof is as follows: if God, the definition of God is the being of which there can be no greater being. The being for which there is no greater being, that's the definition of God. There cannot be a being that's greater than this being. That's the definition of God. Step two. If this being, God, is perfect in all ways, he must exist. Because existence is part of his perfection. Because a being that doesn't exist is not the greatest being that there could be. And my mind can't perceive any being greater than God. So must be, he exists. Yeah. It's not going to be... The greatest possible being that there could be is God. Number two, for that being to be perfect, the most best being, most perfect being that there could be, he must exist. Number three, if there was an existence, if God didn't exist, then my mind would be able to perceive an even greater being. So therefore, he exists. Which basically, in simple English, means like this. Because I'm able to understand that God is the greatest possible being that there could be, and the greatest, my mind understands that God is this greatest possible being that there could be, and if he didn't actually exist, my mind would be able to perceive an even greater being, so must be that he does exist. Now, yeah?
Just so I understand, so like the Mahayana of believing in God comes from the fact that you can't perceive a
correct. The machayev of God's existence that you can't perceive it being greater than God.
That necessarily proves that.
What'd you say? That does or doesn't necessarily
that
prove?
Does that necessarily prove?
That's what Anselm said. So already in his time, just a couple of months after he published his proof, there was a contemporary of his, he was a bishop. There was another bishop that wrote back to him, to Anselm as follows. And it was in the same day, another Christian bishop wrote back to him, according to your proof, if I could perceive the most beautiful island that there could possibly be, the greatest possible, most beautiful island that's a perfect island, it therefore must exist. Because if it didn't exist, then I'd be able to understand an even greater island. So, which obviously is not true. You could fantasize all you want, the greatest possible island that there could be. It doesn't mean that therefore it exists. Or the way Kant himself disagrees with Anselm. The way that Kant explains, he disagrees, and he says, the famous phrase, existence is not a predicate. Which is a little difficult. Let me quickly explain what that means. Existence is not a predicate. Does everyone know what a predicate means? Huh? No? Anyone remember, if you remember in grammar, subject and predicate? You have the subject of the sentence and the predicate, right? Is this a full sentence? John walks. Is that a full sentence? Sure it is. Yes it is. It's a kosher sentence. John walks, period. Because you have a subject and a predicate. John is the subject, walks is the predicate. This orange and purple strong lion ate cereal for dinner. This purple, hairy, orange, purple lion is the subject of the sentence. Ate cereal for dinner, or, you know, licked his cub, that's the predicate of the sentence. Meaning, the verb, what the subject is doing. Predicate means what the subject is doing. Now, if I would describe to you, I don't even have to, like this. Let's say, if I would describe to you a fantastical creature, in every way, whether that creature exists or not is not a predicate. Which means like this. Let's take an example. Harry Potter. Does Harry Potter really exist? Or Santa Claus? Nyana Diyayma. Does Santa Claus really exist? No. If, let's say, Santa Claus would exist, would anything be added to what Santa Claus is? Other than the fact that he exists. You know, imagine you have this full description of what Harry Potter is, what Santa Claus is, and all of a sudden they actually exist. as exactly as you have it described in your head. Has anything been added to them now? Has anything been added to their metzias? You heard him? Has Santa Claus changed by the fact that he exists now? No. Santa Claus is the same Santa Claus whether he exists or not. Existence is not a predicate. Existence, you know, Rabbi, could you tell me a little about, you know, I'm going on a shidduch day. Tell me about that girl. Well, she exists. She exists. Has anything been added to you about your knowledge of that person? Anyone put on their shidduch resume, I exist? Existence is not a description of a subject, philosophically speaking. I could have a complete description of everything God is, but that doesn't mean that it actually exists, lemaisa. The fact that my head could understand something perfectly doesn't make that it actually manifests as existing, and it wouldn't change my description of God. Tell me if I'm not being clear, tell me. Nachamol, let's say it again. Existence is not a predicate means when you want to understand something. Name me anything. Give me a game, let's say. I want to understand how... Well, that's not a good example. Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan exists, but the way you understand him... The way you know him, let's say for a second that Michael Jordan doesn't really exist. Anyone ever meet him before? No. It could be that there's this huge conspiracy among the media and whatever the basketball league that they made up this figure called Michael Jordan. They made pictures of him. They drew really good pictures of him. They made this, you know, this robot that looks exactly like Michael Jordan. So he doesn't really exist. Does that change at all the metzias of who Michael Jordan is? No, because existence is not a predicate. Existence is not something added to what you are. It doesn't describe anything about you. So basically, Kant said, the fact that my mind could understand God as being the ultimate greatest thing doesn't mean that automatically, therefore, it exists. Clear? If it's not clear, that's fine. I'm just going through this l'shleimus ha'inyan, but like I said to you, you don't need to know these proofs because we're going to get to in a second that they're all not great proofs. So the ontological proof, that's from this Anselm of Canterbury, and it's been shot down throughout the years. However, I do want to say, also l'shleimus ha'inyan, I do want to say that Bertrand Russell, anyone that's familiar with philosophy knows Bertrand Russell was one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, a British chap. And Bertrand Russell wrote that later on in his life, when he was like once walking for hours and hours, all of a sudden he said he chapped the depth of Anselm of Canterbury's ontological proof, and like he said, he started dancing. Like he finally chapped what Anselm was saying, because it really doesn't sound like it makes a lot of sense, his proof. Like it really doesn't sound to make a lot of sense, but Russell says there's a very deep depth to it, which he said he only got later on. Let's leave that on the side. In Judaism, you don't find the ontological proof. In Judaism, all those rabbis that you've learned throughout your years that are trying to prove you that God exists, there are two proofs that you always do find in Judaism. And that's the cosmological proof and the teleological proof. The cosmological proof is the proof from creation, which is very simple. There's a world, obviously somebody created it. Very simple. If there's reality, if there's a world, if there's creation, the cosmos... That's why it's called the cosmological proof. If there is a cosmos, if there is a world, everything has to have a cause. Everything has to have a cause. You had a cause, which is your parents had a cause, which was their parents. Everything has to have a cause until you finally trace back what's causing everything to happen. Now, why is that not a good proof? Before we get to Kant for a second, why is that? What's the usual tying against that proof? What would you say if I would say to you, proof to God exists from the fact that there is a world? Why is that not a good proof? That's one. There could be causes that don't have a conscious being behind it, or the ultimate proof. You could say, then who created God? Which is a complete misunderstanding of this proof. But that's what people would say. Well, who created God? That's that. The reason that that's not a good taina, we'll get to Mitzvah Shem when we explain more. But that's the usual taina against that one. The teleological proof is the proof from design. a telos. Telos means that there's a design, there's a point, that there's an order to reality, which is the proof that's seemingly found in the Medrash. Everyone knows that it's in a million versions of it, right? Rabbi Akiva says that if there's a house, that everything is in its proper order, somebody must have designed it. If you found, you know, I love when people like make it into a whole maisa. Bjornis and Ivshitz, I've already heard, Psagansa Maisa. That one time that somebody asked Bjornis and Ivshitz, how do you prove that God, it's really a medrash, how do you prove that God exists? So he says, you see this book over here, I spilled ink, and the book came out. So of course that would be absolutely irrational and silly to think such a thing. So obviously the world also must be this intelligent design. That's the teleological proof. No, it's the proof from creation bechlal, that's the cosmological proof. There has to be a cause. And the theological proof is the proof from intelligent design, that creation has an order to it, that everything makes sense. Now, without getting into the whole pilpulum of the proofs and stuff, came along Immanuel Kant, and this is very important to understand. And he said, the ganze Sach hebt sich nicht an, the whole thing doesn't even begin. Immanuel Kant, the reason that he's considered one of the most important philosophers in history, and he forever changed all thought, really, including Jewish thought. I mean, all, you know, not just the Rav that was a Neo-Kantian, but all of Jewish thought is after, you know, what he wrote. And he wrote a very famous book called The Critique of Pure Reason. That's his famous book, The Critique of Pure Reason. And essentially what Kant says is as follows, because of you could spend years and years studying it. I'm going to try to say it in 2 minutes. What Kant essentially says is, if you're always wearing green glasses, always, what will everything always look like? Green, right? Now, if our seichel, our mind says, if there's design, there's an intelligence behind it. If there's reality, if something exists, must be something brought into existence. These are all things that our mind is using, correct? My mind says to me that if this chair moves, I see something move, there must be something that moved it. My mind says that. It's what's called causality. Causality is that every action has a cause. My mind says to me that if there's intelligent design, must be something was putting it into order. Who made that the digestive system should work, and then, you know, the food gets digested, and then it gives the blood, which is the circulation system? Must be this intelligent design. All these must-bes are based on the premise that my mind is functioning, that my mind functions, and my mind, you ready to this? Listen carefully. My mind corresponds to reality. The way my mind is saying must be what's going on in the world. But says Kant, if you're always wearing green glasses and you start saying a million pulpulum about the world being green, why is that ridiculous? I'm wearing green glasses, so I write whole books explaining why the world is green. No. If you're wearing green glasses, you can write all you want explaining why the world is green. You're wasting your time. Why? Because the fact that the world is green appears to you is because you're wearing green glasses. That doesn't correspond to reality. Kant proved almost impeccably that the brain that we have is our green glasses. It doesn't tell you anything about the world itself. To the extent that Kant says like this, if I would say to you, time and space, does time exist? Does the world, is there such a thing as space in the world? Forget about causality. My mind says that if this thing moves, something must have moved it. My mind says to me that if I'm going to hit this cap, it's going to move. That's how my mind says to me. Now, that implies that there's such a thing as space. Space really exists. Time really exists, right? According to Kant, it doesn't. Time and space are categories that your mind uses. Your mind has 12 categories. Your mind the glasses that your mind wears is time and space. Could any of you try to picture something that exists outside of time and space? We believe God is outside time and space. Try to picture what it's like to be outside of time or not existing in space. Your mind can't do it, right? You can't picture not being in time and space. So we assume that's because that's how reality is. Says Kant, no, those are the green glasses that your brain is wearing. Your brain is wearing green spectacles called time, space, measurement, etc. Your brain processes things, which, by the way, till today is actually very, very much, you know, even psychologically true. I'll give you an example. Anyone here study psychology at all? So what's trauma? Define trauma. It's a hard word to define. Okay, anyone? Trauma. What's a traumatic experience? And why is it so damaging? Psychologically, yeah?
And it's just something, an incident that happened that causes extreme distress.
How does it cause extreme distress? Yes, it causes extreme distress. How? What about that incident?
You continue to experience it.
Why do you continue experiencing it later on? Because it was such a difficult incident that your emotions and your mind doesn't know how to process it. It's too much for your mind and your emotions to handle. So it totally, because you can't, your mind and your emotions can't digest it, can't process it. It hits your soul so hard, like imagine I throw you a ball. You'll catch it. But if I throw an anvil at you, you know what an anvil is? Remember from the Roadrunner? That always falls on the Wile E. Coyote, you know, an anvil? If I throw at you, you know, a 500-pound anvil, you won't be able to catch it. It'll knock you down. So an experience that's so much that your mind and your emotions can't handle it, it knocks your soul down. It can't assimilate it. And therefore it leaves this imprint on you of not being able to assimilate, and that's why you don't know how to digested into your being. And that's what Kant says, really, all of what we know is our mind digesting stuff. And our mind only digests stuff with time, space, measurement, but that doesn't tell you anything about the world itself. If you're always wearing green glasses, you don't know what color the world really is. So Kant says, I'm proving God exists by the fact that there must be a cause. How do you know? How do you know there has to be always a cause for something? Maybe something could happen without a cause. Maybe letters could just randomly come up. You've never seen it. Your mind can't perceive that. Okay, our green glasses mind can't assimilate, can't understand, can't digest how something can happen without a cause. Your mind also can't digest without time and space. So what Kant essentially did is he said the whole idea of having a proof for anything is useless. You can't prove this table really exists. Because anything you're experiencing is your mind wearing those glasses of the reality that your mind perceives with. But what's interesting is that Kant, in his next book, Critique of Pure of Practical Reason, that was Critique of Pure Reason. In his next book, Critique of Practical Reason, does quote-unquote, not say prove, but he says, I can, however, because people were like, you know, Kant himself was a religious person, and people were like, oh my God, does that mean there's no God? So Kant says, no, there's a God, but Kant's indication of the existence of God is not from rational proofs. What's fascinating is, you know what Kant says in Critique of Practical Reason? He says, but you know how I can know God exists? Not from any proofs, but for the feeling of morality that we have in us. The feeling of morality that we have in us, that we all have in us, this deep feeling of right and wrong. Healthy people. It's, by the way, one of the most famous things. Kant's epitaph, what's written on his grave, is, two things fill me with ever-increasing awe and wonder, the starry heavens above me and the moral law within me. Two things fill me with ever-increasing awe and wonder, the starry heavens above me and the moral voice within me. And the Gerald Schroeder actually has a beautiful vart, and he says, and they're both coming from the same place, right? But Lamaisa, but Kant, so what Kant says, I could know God exists from the moral law within me, and that really is very much like what I said already, is a taste of what Hasidus will say Emunah is. The experience of what you have in you that's not necessarily cognitive. It's not necessarily cognitive. There's something inside me that I feel that the way Kant says, that everybody distinguishes right from wrong. Now, of course, you say, well, there are societies where it's okay to kill people. So not all societies define right and wrong correctly. Of course, Kant knew that. Not all societies will define right and wrong the same. But in all societies, there's always been some definition of what's right and what's wrong. So the specifics are not the point. The fact that a person has that moral law within them, that Kant says, that's where he says, well, you can induce the fact that there's a God. Whatever. But the bottom line I want to say is that according to Kant, and here's the bottom line, this is what you need to know. According to Kant, your mind can't prove anything about objective reality. Now, does that mean that your mind disproves God? Not at all. It just essentially means your mind can't prove anything one way or the other. My mind can't even prove that you exist. I can't prove to anyone that I exist. The mind isn't able to prove anything objectively true. Which is why that's what Rav Shagar writes so clearly, that since the 19th century, Hasidus has been so important in the idea of connecting to Hashem. And if you want to listen to my halachic man classes, when I spoke a lot about Kant, I spoke about this a lot, but historically, Hasidus came at the same time as Kant. And Imamish, as if like HaKadosh Baruch Hu was preparing the way for Chassidus and says, it's almost like Hashem is preparing the world for this new Chelek of Torah that's being revealed. Kant comes and says to the whole world, what your mind says doesn't prove anything. Don't just use your mind. It's not going to be able to tell you anything about the actual objective reality. And therefore we have to understand that Emunah is coming from a much deeper place. So Mitzvah Shem, next week we're going to speak about, so according to the Rishonim, what is Emunah? And again, it's not just the fact that God exists. It's not just the fact that God exists, but what we're going to learn Mitzvah Shem more is what does that mean to be able to tap into that not from a place of seichel. Yes, using your seichel, but not cognitive using logic. We'll continue Mitzvah Shem next week.